You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
We are listening to the Space Show. It used to be simple, counting Australian-built satellites, that is. There had been two, built in the 1960s, ResatOne and Australis Oscar 5. Then, in 2002, came FedSat, which started as an overseas build but was finished off in Australia. All other Australian satellites were built in the United States or, in one case, Russia. In between those were a lot of proposals. Paper satellites, one might call them. A few drawings and reams of paper submitted to committees and government. Nothing ever came of them. Suddenly, in the past couple of years, things have changed. Already this year, three Australian-built satellites are in orbit, as is another with Australian and New Zealand-built components. As we speak, an Australian satellite is sitting on the launch pad atop a rocket at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. If all goes well, this Friday evening it will be blasted into space. And right now, other satellites are under construction here in Australia. One could be excused for being confused. That confusion not reduced by vague and overblown statements by government ministers. On this evening's and next week's The Space Show, we endeavour to clarify things for you. We will explain names like Buccaneer, Biari, MISO, QKD, RAF, and M-cubed. On Friday evening at 8:47, a Delta II rocket will be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The primary payload is a satellite for the United States' National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It is the first in a new series of weather satellites. Currently called JPIS-1, it will be called NOAA-20 if it reaches orbit. JPISS, that's J-P-S-S, is an acronym for Joint Polar Satellite System. More about this revolutionary satellite in a moment. Tucked away inside the Delta II's payload fairing at the top of the rocket is a Hitchhiker, a tiny Australian satellite called BRMM, the Buccaneer Risk Mitigation Mission. More about this anon.
The Joint Polar Satellite System is the nation's next generation of polar orbiting environmental satellites. JPSS represents significant technological and scientific advancement in severe weather prediction and environmental monitoring. JPSS satellites circle the Earth from pole to pole and cross the equator 14 times daily in the afternoon orbit, providing full global coverage twice a day. In fact, polar satellite data is considered the backbone of the weather forecast. JPSS satellites simultaneously provide sophisticated meteorological data and observations of atmosphere, ocean, and land for short-term seasonal and long-term monitoring and forecasting. JPSS data increases the timeliness and accuracy of forecasts 3 to 7 days in advance of severe weather events. NOAA's National Weather Service uses JPSS data as a critical input for numerical forecast models, providing the basis for essential mid-range forecasts. These forecasts allow for early warnings and enable emergency managers to make timely decisions to protect American lives and property, including ordering effective evacuations. JPSS satellites also provide critical observations in polar regions. In Alaska, JPSS supports essential forecasting for economically vital aviation, maritime, oil, and gas industries. JPSS also enables scientists and forecasters to monitor and predict weather patterns with greater accuracy and to study long-term climate trends by extending the more than 30-year satellite data record. Satellites in the JPSS constellation host state-of-the-art instruments. They are the Advanced Technology Microwave Sounder, Cross-Track Infrared Sounder, Visible Infrared Imaging Radiometer Suite, Ozone Mapping and Profiler Suite, and an instrument to measure the Earth's radiation budget. Together, these instruments gather global measurements of atmospheric, terrestrial, and oceanic conditions, including atmospheric temperature and moisture, hurricane intensity, clouds, rainfall, dense fog, volcanic ash, fire location and smoke plumes, sea and land surface temperatures, vegetation, snow and ice cover, and ozone. Information from JPSS satellites supports every area of NOAA's mission, including ensuring a more weather-ready nation, healthy coasts, resilient coastal communities, and adapting and mitigating climate change.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
And now on the Space Show, let's turn our attention to that Aussie hitchhiker, BRMM, the Buccaneer Risk Mitigation Mission. This has been built in a partnership between the Defence Science and Technology Group and the University of New South Wales. Now, quite possibly the first attentive followers of Senator Maurice Payne would have heard of the satellite was on October 10 last year when she popped over to the Canberra campus of the University of New South Wales to make this announcement.
Well, it's a great opportunity for me to be here at the University of New South Wales in Canberra this morning to announce a very, very important and exciting collaboration between Defence and the University. As we indicated in the 2016 White Paper, we are strengthening our space surveillance and situational awareness capabilities. And to achieve this, we are collaborating with university and industry partners to foster and grow Australia's space engineering capability. We will continue to work closely also with our international allies to participate in and contribute to collaborative research in the space domain. These research programs are to conduct GPS, space situational awareness and calibration experiments. That is their purpose. I'm very pleased to have the chance to be here today and to have spent some time with the experts, the very serious experts, talking about the capability and what we are embarking upon here. I'd like now to invite Professor Michael Frater, the Rector of the of UNSW in Canberra, and then Dr. Janice Cocking on behalf of the Chief Defence Scientist from DSTG to say a few words. Michael.
Minister and Acting CDS, welcome to you and some of you, Canberra. It's a very happy day today because we're launching a really important partnership, I think, for the future of space in Australia. The global space sector is currently undergoing transformation. Traditional actors such as wealthy nations and major international aerospace primes and traditional approaches such as large and expensive satellites, are now able to do some things, but they're no longer the be-all and end-all of space capability. At UNSW Canberra, we're investing $10 million over a five-year period to build a space capability to take advantage of this technology improvement. We are investing in a team of highly skilled scientists and engineers with enormous accumulated international experience. And what we have done is, this program is to play our part in reversing the brain drain. We look forward to the journey ahead, engaging with Defence and other organisations in Australia and around the world to provide a level of self-reliance for Australia in space that we have never had before. Thank you.
On October 10 last year, that was Senator Maurice Payne and Professor Michael Frater announcing the Buccaneer mission. Well, 2 weeks earlier, the Space Show had been briefed on the Buccaneer mission by Douglas Griffin, the space missions lead at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. Speaking at the Australian Space Research Conference at RMIT University here in Melbourne, he gave us a report on the status of the Buccaneer program as it stood at that time.
Yep, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to talk this afternoon. So today, it's the amount of work that's gone into this program, the BRMM program, over the past 12 months is remarkable. On Friday, we got a one of the last milestones was achieved. So Mark and his team at the Space Coordination Office, we've got the Overseas Launch Certificate approved for Buccaneer Risk Mitigation Mission. So that's a really positive step, and thanks for all your help in getting that through. So some of the indication of all the work that's gone on this program in the past 12 months is evidenced by the number of talks at the conference on Buccaneer. So overall, the presentation this afternoon, I'll be talking about the program itself. I'll be talking about the design of the spacecraft, launch and early operations, and then finally the status of the program. So what is the Buccaneer program? Well, it's a two-launch series of missions. So the first launch is the Buccaneer Risk Mitigation Mission. Currently, it's scheduled to launch on the 16th of March next year into a sun-synchronous orbit. And itself, it's a technology demonstrator for the main mission. But at the same time, it's an excellent opportunity to allow the university to carry out some experiments in space situational awareness. And the Buccaneer mission itself, the main mission, we don't have a launch date in pen at the moment, because it's contingent on how well the risk mitigation mission goes. But we're hoping that we'll be able to launch it as quickly as possible after the risk mitigation mission. So who's involved? It's quite a large team. It's made up of people in groups in Australia, so DST Group in Adelaide and UNSW Canberra, plus partners in the US. So the spacecraft platform itself was procured from Pumpkin, and there's US agencies that are providing the launch service and also are interfacing between our platform, our spacecraft, and the launcher to make sure that all of those interfaces are squared away. So what is the purpose of the mission? Well, payload on the main mission is a high-frequency receiver mounted on the spacecraft. And the reason that the receiver is there, it's to measure the signal from the Dawn radar in space, and also to look at the transionospheric propagation of those high-frequency signals. So what are the requirements for that payload on the main mission? Well, it's a very broadband receiver in the high-frequency band, 3 to 45 megahertz, collecting data over very wide bandwidth. And the main requirements can be summarised is that it needs to be compatible with the CubeSat resources available, so power, size and weight. And it also needs to be compatible with the launch and the space environments. The flight payload that will go up in March next year, all things being equal. UNSW Canberra has designed a camera to image the antenna in the deployed state. One of the main reasons for flying this camera is to verify the deployment of the antenna during its various stages. We've done some testing in the laboratory to show that the sensitivity of the camera is suitable for the illumination conditions that we're expecting to see in flight. And we can the Pumpkin bus, it's a customised MISC-3 bus. So it's got a PIC processor, S-band transmitter. It's got a customised helium 100 UHF radio, Clyde Space batteries and power supply, fifth generation solar panels, an MAI 400 attitude control system, ISIS space UHF deployable antennas, and the chassis itself was supplied by Pumpkin. So the CONOPS for the spacecraft. So it's launched, and then after launch, the spacecraft is ejected from the P-pod, and the spacecraft autonomously detumbles. And once the spacecraft's has detumbled and it's acquired a controlled attitude, then the spacecraft solar arrays are deployed, and then the high-frequency payload antenna is deployed, and then it's remains deployed until the end of mission. What's not shown in this diagram, obviously, is some of the light curve, some of the space situational awareness experiments that will be carried out on the spacecraft during various stages of its operational life. So the RF operations for the main mission. So this isn't on the risk mitigation mission, it's on the main mission. The payload operations are cyclic. So the commands to take a collection are uploaded onto the spacecraft, and then the payload's put into a hibernation state, and then at the correct time the HF signal is acquired, and then the spacecraft's put into hibernation or a sleep state again, and then a command is sent up to the spacecraft to do processing, data processing on the acquired signals. And then once that processing has been completed, then the data is ready to downlink. And so the S-band is commanded to downlink the data, the ground station, the ground segment, and the cycle can continue. So where are we up to now? Well, the spacecraft platform was delivered from the States to us in March this year. The payload was integrated in July. We commenced the environmental tests in August, the shock and the vibe tests. We had a mishap during that test, so we had to carry out some delta environmental tests in September. The final system verification tests are going to be happening next month, and then the spacecraft's going to be reviewed in December, and then in January the spacecraft's going to be delivered to the States and integrated, and then 16th of March is launch.
Speaking at the Australian Space Research Conference at RMIT last year, that was Douglas Griffin, the Space Missions Lead at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. We've already mentioned the 50-year-long dearth of Australian-built satellites. It is a rare day that space gets a mention in our Parliament. Search Hansard for the word space, and you will find plenty of uses of the word in the context of office space and such like. And so, we at the Space Show took notice in August this year when we came across this in the Senate question time.
Senator Bushby.
Thank you, Mr. President. My question is to the Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science, Senator Sinodinos. Can the Minister update the Senate on what the Turnbull government is doing to support a growing space industry in Australia?
The Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science, Senator Sinodinos.
Well, thank you, Senator Bushby, for this timely question. There are a lot of exciting things happening in Australia's space sector. Just this week, we saw the launch of Cube Rider 2, which I was delighted to authorise. A payload programmed by Australian students blasted off to the International Space Station to gather data from space. A great thing to be talking about in this Space Week when we're trying to get the young people of Australia to take an interest in science, technology, engineering and maths. Mr. President, the Turnbull government recognises the incredible potential of our space industry to drive investment, create jobs and position us as a global industry leader. That's why we've commissioned a review of Australia's space industry capability. It will examine the role of government in supporting a strong, competitive space industry and the best way for us to harness our industry advantages. This is not about whether we should have a space industry. We have one. This is about the framework to take the space industry to the next stage. It will support leadership, innovation, opportunity and entrepreneurship across the sector, along with our broader national interests. The result of this review will be a national strategy for the sector, a strategy that reflects both our developing strengths and national interests over the next decade. An important part of the review will also be establishing the case for a national space agency to act as a coordinator of space policy across the government, and to act as an interlocutor on the global stage when we interact with other players so we can look them in the eye and develop the networks and the contracts which are needed to take the space industry to the next level. This will be a very important development to be able to put together a space strategy for not only the next decade but for the next two decades, recognising there are many great Australians who work in this sector, including people who are working overseas who we want to bring back to
Thank
Australia.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering the question has expired. Senator Bushby, supplementary question.
Thank you, Mr. President. I do have a supplementary question. And it's delighting. I'm personally delighted to hear the steps that are being taken to help promote these developments in the space industry as possibly the only member here who was part of the Economics References Committee inquiry into the space industry back in about... I wish I could say that. In about 2007. So we made a number of recommendations back then which have yet to be...
Do you have a question?
It's great to see they're finally being acted on. Now, I do have a supplementary.
Your time has expired, Senator Bushby. Time has expired.
Can I comment on that?
Now, I'm happy to respond. I get the drift of the question.
Order.
I think I know where he's going.
Order on my left. Minister Sandistor, Minister, I'll invite you to make any comments in response to the question you may thought you were going to get. Minister.
Well, I thank the honourable member for his supplementary question. I get the gist. I understand. We are witnessing, Mr. President, a period of rapid growth and change in the space
industry.
Order
on my left. Order.
Mr. President, no longer is the industry open to a few countries and companies capable of launching large and very expensive satellites into space. It's a global industry worth over $300 billion a year, and more of our daily life is dependent on space technology. It's important we have a clear vision and strategy for our industry, but we can't make policy on the run. That's why the review is being undertaken under the direction of an expert reference group being chaired by Megan Clark, AC, an eminent Australian innovator and the former head of CSIRO. The review is supported by a consultation process seeking views from across industry, government and the wider community. We will be holding roundtables asking our fellow Australians about the best way forward.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Bushby, a further supplementary question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. I do have a further supplementary.
Thank you.
And I'm going to do my my best to keep an eye on the
clock
to make sure that I get an opportunity to ask. How does this work outlined by the Minister complement the government's other space industry initiatives which are currently underway?
Minister.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you, the Honourable Senator, for that very specific question. The current review will complement the activity already undertaken by this government to support growth in the space industry in Australia. In October 2015, we announced a review of the Space Activities Act 1998, an act that regulates space activities undertaken by Australians here and overseas. Space technologies have advanced significantly since the Act was legislated. Barriers to entry in the space industry are disappearing. This is creating new opportunities for Australian firms. So the Act must provide an appropriate balance between supporting opportunities for participation and ensuring that Australia meets its international obligations. The review of the Act is now complete and the proposed amendments are being drafted. We're making sure the legislation supports innovation and the advancement of space technologies in Australia. Combined with the current review, it demonstrates our commitment as a coalition to the success and growth of Australian industry.
Thank you, Minister.
That was the Federal Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science, Senator Sinodinos, answering questions in the Senate Question Time on 2017, August the 17th. Now, this comment should be seen in the context of the lead-up to September's announcement of the intention to form an Australian Space Agency. Now, after these announcements, we will return to the topic of Buccaneer.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Hi, I'm David Lingard, and I'm the team leader for our small satellite experimentation here at in DST Group. The important thing that's happened in recent decades, really, is just the miniaturisation of electronics, which means that you can fit systems into these small volumes that can achieve quite meaningful missions. With our Buccaneer mission, the key thing that we're trying to achieve there is we're putting a digital high-frequency receiver up into orbit, into low Earth orbit, and we're going to use that receiver to receive signals from the Jindalee Operational Radar Network transmitters, which that's our over-the-horizon radar system in defence. So, in terms of understanding how well the drone transmitting arrays are working, it's very useful to have a control target that we understand really, really well, such as the Buccaneer spacecraft, a long way away from the transmitting arrays. And that's why Buccaneer is so useful in this context. So it's receiving those signals directly from the transmitting arrays. And what that allows us to do is to better understand how healthy the transmitting arrays are, to better understand how the transmitting arrays are illuminating targets, such as aircraft, and also to better understand how the effect of that the ionosphere has on that illumination of targets. So once we collect that data and analyse it and perform the calibration activities, what that is really leading to is the ability to use Jawn to more accurately locate where targets are. And of course, that's very, very beneficial for our surveillance and reconnaissance activities. We're indebted to our US partners who have provided us with a launch opportunity. So we're going to launch in 2017 on a NASA Delta II rocket. And that's a tremendous privilege to be working with NASA and to get that opportunity. We've also been working in very, very close collaboration with our partners at the University of New South Wales, Canberra. And so they're our partners in the Buccaneer missions. And that's been a very successful collaboration. So for the Buccaneer mission, we're going to have two ground stations. We'll have one here at Edinburgh that's being built by DST Group, and the University of New South Wales Canberra will have another ground station in Canberra, and so we'll have those two facilities to be able to communicate with the satellite. Here at DST Group, my team are very, very excited about this mission and about pushing the envelope in terms of Australia's involvement in space and space engineering.
Now, just summarising the Buccaneer, it'll be making calibration measurements of Jawn, the Jindalee Operational Radar Network, and it will use advanced high-frequency receiver, and will provide data that will enhance the capability of Jawn to more accurately locate targets such as aircraft. And this capability is highly beneficial for Australian surveillance and reconnaissance activities. The reminder that the launch of the risk mitigation mission is going to be this Friday at 8:47 Australian Eastern Daylight Time. That's 8:47 p.m. And in America, that'll be the Pacific Standard Time of 1:47 a.m. So a night launch for the Delta II from Vandenberg Air Force Base. The Buccaneer is covered in solar cells to provide power. It has a large, lightweight, flexible radio antenna, which will unfurl after the satellite reaches orbit. And it actually uses Stanley-type tape measures, as did our first-built satellite, second-launched. That's Australis OSCAR. And, the orbit will be in 600 kilometres altitude. Now, I have advice from Doug Griffin of the Australian Defence Force Academy in Canberra. On Monday this week, he advised me that the Buccaneer main mission will be launched. The launch date has not yet been finalised, and it depends on the flight characteristics of BRMM. But at the moment, the best guess is 12 to 18 months after the Buccaneer risk mitigation mission. Well, let's now turn our attention back to JPIS-1, and here's a teleconference that we recorded several weeks ago about JPIS-1.
JPSS, which stands for Joint Polar Satellite System, will bring the latest and best technology NOAA has ever flown to capture more precise and timely observations of the Earth's atmosphere, land, and waters that help improve NOAA's life-saving weather forecast out to 7 days. In 2011, NOAA and our partner NASA launched SUMI-NPP, the precursor to JPSS-1, which was designed as a research mission to test a new technology that would fly on JPSS-1. However, SUMI-NPP was pressed into operations to ensure continuity of the invaluable data from the polar orbit, especially if one of NOAA's current polar satellites failed before JPSS-1 was ready. In May 2014, SUMI-NPP became NOAA's primary polar orbiting weather satellite and has performed quite well. JPSS-1 will join SUMI-NPP, giving NOAA the benefit of two advanced polar orbiting satellites in the same orbit. And once declared operational, NOAA will have the first next-generation polar satellite and the first next-generation geosatellite, GOES-16, working in tandem. Bringing the first JPSS satellite to the launch pad has been a true team effort among NOAA, NASA, our international partners, and our contract teams. who built JPSS-1 and the JPSS-1 ground system. Next, we'll have Greg Mant, director of the JPSS program.
Thanks, AJ. As you've just heard, JPSS-1 is going to bring the latest, most advanced technology that NOAA has ever flown in the polar orbit to produce accurate 3 to 7 day weather forecasts. The JPSS series, which is going to include 4 satellites, J1 through J4, will provide these global data sets from now through the year 2038. To provide the observations, JPSS carries 5 highly sophisticated instruments. Instruments so precise that they can measure temperatures to better than 1/10 of a degree in the entire atmosphere from the Earth's surface up to the edge of space. The first of these is the Advanced Technology Microwave Sounder, or ATMS. This instrument measures the atmospheric temperature and moisture. It's an instrument that collects data in a microwave, which is emitted from the Earth's atmosphere and surface all day and night. So we can see the temperature and moisture through clouds, whether it's night or day, that typically will block other instruments. The second instrument is the Cross-Track Infrared Sounder, or CRIS. This instrument provides more accurate, that 1/10 of a degree, detailed atmospheric temperature and moisture, but only for cloud-free areas. This instrument has over 2,000 channels, and that compares to the current POSE satellite flying instrument of a similar capability that only had 19 channels. The third instrument is the Visible Infrared Imaging Radiometer Suite, the VIRS, which is used for weather forecasting and environmental assessments, such as determining sea surface temperatures or tracking floods and fires. Recently, imagery from VIRS, which is on the SUMI NPP, has been on full display. So for all the hurricanes we've seen and the fires, you've seen very sharp images from the VIRS, including a couple weeks ago on the front page of Time magazine. The next instrument is the Ozone Mapping and Profiler Suite, or OMPS. That tracks the health of the ozone layer of the Earth and measures concentration of ozone in the Earth's atmosphere. Products derived from the OMPS are used to track dangerous UV radiation that can increase our risk of cancer, but also helps us monitor the size of the Antarctic ozone hole. The last instrument is the Cloud and Earth Radiant Energy System, or CERES. It's an instrument that measures the reflective sunlight and thermal radiation emitted by clear and cloudy skies above the Earth, from the Earth. All of these instruments work in tandem. For example, the VIRS can tell us the location of a fire and track a smoke plume, while the CRIS instrument can measure the carbon monoxide and methane emanating from the fire, allowing us to see where the air quality may be affected. We're launching the JPSS-1 into the same orbit of SUMI NPP, but 50 minutes behind it, so that they are passing over the northern pole every orbit. Our European partner, EUMETSAT, provides the satellite data offset about 6 hours from these satellites, so we get the good measurement of the whole atmosphere. And together, you get a full complement of global data feeding NOAA's weather forecast models. And because it passes over the North Pole every 90 minutes, JPSS-1 has a unique vantage point to regularly observe the Alaska and the Arctic, unmatched by other satellites or ground sensors. Next, I'll turn it over to Dr. Louis Ugolini, the director of the National Weather Service. Take it away, Louis.
Well, thanks, Greg, and it is a pleasure to be here. As we have just seen during this year's hurricane season, one of NOAA's National Weather Service's most critical missions is to provide emergency managers with extended forecasts out to day 7 with accurate, consistent, and high confidence levels that they need to make critical decisions that protect American lives and property. Ordering effective evacuations, pre-positioning response assets, and adequately preparing the public to take appropriate action well in advance of landfalling hurricanes. We saw how this worked for Harvey, Hurricane Harvey, where decisions and preparedness were underway 5 days before landfall and record flooding. We saw this for Irma in the Caribbean islands, had 5 to 7 days to prepare, and Florida's governor declared a state of emergency 6 days before landfall to facilitate evacuations and other life-saving preparedness. We saw this for Maria, where Puerto Rico started preparing for the worst 5 days before landfall. In all of these events, the death rates were well below previous historic storms such as Katrina. These well-coordinated preparedness decisions for these storms were based on forecasts that rely on global numerical prediction systems, which absolutely need global observing systems such as polar orbiting satellites to make these forecasts. So the forecasting that you've seen are impossible without robust, high-quality global measurements of the atmosphere required to initialize our numerical weather prediction systems.